Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's Healthline. This is where we like to focus on ways to live a happier, healthier, and pain-free life. We'll be taking your calls and answering your questions live in the studio today. We'll be opening these phone lines, and as a reminder, make sure you are in a quiet room when you call with your TV turned all the way down. Our number is 318-219-4569. Today, we are talking about innovations in permanent contraceptives. Joining me today to talk about this is Dr. Amanda Button, an obstetrician and gynecologist from Willis-Knighton Women's Health Clinic. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yes, same to you.
All right, so let's just jump right into it. Tell me a little bit about permanent contraceptives. What are they? What purpose do they serve?
Okay, permanent contraception is really what we kind of consider tying your tubes, although we don't tie tubes any longer. There were various ways to do this back several years, decades ago. The most common probably was tying tubes, maybe at the postpartum. So after you would have a baby, you would later go back to the operating room, have a small incision made underneath your belly button, because your uterus right after delivery is hitched just at the top of the belly button.
Gotcha.
Right underneath the belly button. So it was like easy access at that time frame, just to make a small little incision under the belly button, grab the tubes, remove a small little piece in the middle of the tube so that the far end does not connect to the end that's closest to the uterus. We call these the proximal and distal ends. And so you're missing a chunk of tube in the middle so that the tube doesn't connect. We do this on both sides, and then you're done. Cool. Outside of the postpartum period, people were doing things called filchi clips and fallope rings, like putting clips on the tube to squish it down and kind of make it to where it's no longer open there, or kind of knuckling up the tube and then putting a ring around it to constrict it, or just burning a segment of tube in the middle, so again, so that the sperm and the egg cannot meet to get fertilized.
Right.
Nowadays, we are doing what's called a bilateral self-injectomy, which is just removal of both tubes, completely whole, like the entire tube. We're not leaving any tube except the tiny little portion that's like within the uterine cavity itself.
Gotcha. So this is the new way of doing
it. This is a new way of doing it. And the reason we move to this method is one, for effectiveness, and two, for the ovarian cancer risk. We now know that a lot of ovarian cancers probably originate in the fallopian tube itself. And so removing the tube will lead to decreased chances of ovarian cancer down the road. Even at the time of like hysterectomy, we are now doing what we call opportunistic self-injectomies. We've got the opportunity there to take out the tubes. They are no longer being used, so you're having hysterectomy anyway. May as well remove them to decrease the risk of ovarian cancer, because most ovaries do stay after a hysterectomy.
Right. So since you basically remove these tubes, it's pretty effective.
Yes.
Pretty effective way.
Yes. So the methods that were used previously, like burning, putting the rings, putting the clips, or the postpartum tubal, where we just cut out a segment in the middle and kind of tie the ends that remain inside. The failure rate on those over a 10-year period of time ranged anywhere from like 7.5 out of 1,000 patients to even like 36.5 out of 1,000 if you're talking about clips.
Gotcha.
So I mean, still, you know, about 1 to 2% when you look at it that way. And
still,
that's over
percent.
Yes. And that's over 10-year period of time. But now with the removal of the tube itself, I was like, we don't have long-term data on it, like 10 years out, because we're just not there yet. However, rates are probably going to approach zero.
Good.
I guess failure rates increase the longer it's been since your tubal ligation, and your age at the time your tubes were tied, because obviously someone who had their tubes tied in their 20s has a lot more fertile years to go than someone who'd had their tubes tied at 45.
Right, and speaking of age, is there a good candidate age range that you would recommend have this procedure?
Okay, so I was like, a lot of this is one of the misinformation I keep hearing from patients. So it's like, you've got to be a certain age, you got to have a certain amount of kids, you got to be married, blah, 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 blah. There is not a specific age. I mean, obviously you have to be a consenting adult. If you have a federal insurance like Medicaid, there is an age minimum, and that is 21. Federal funds cannot be used to tie tubes or sterilize somebody less than 21 years of age. So that's basically the one criteria that Medicaid has to have, and then there has to be a consent form signed 30 days prior to the procedure, and it's valid for 6 months. So you've got to fall in between the 30 days and 6 months. But this is only Medicaid. If you've got private insurance, the form doesn't matter.
Gotcha. Okay, so what is, if someone were to have this procedure, what does the recovery look like? Does it take somebody a couple of weeks or months to get back on their feet, or is it pretty
easy? Now that we're doing these laparoscopically, for the most part, it's minimally invasive. It really involves just two or three little incisions, less than a centimeter in size, on your abdomen. Recovery is very quick. Honestly, most of my patients tell me they take pain medicines 2-3 days tops if they need anything at all.
That's awesome.
And most people are back to work the next week. And like, honestly, I was like, it's not a very hard thing to do.
Good. Any kind of physical limitations, you know, exercising, how long do you usually suggest people wait before exercising after the procedure?
I usually say wait until you feel like you're up to it. There's not anything suture-wise. I'm like, you've got skin sutures, very superficial. I was like, mm-hmm. that may come apart if you do some like very early heavy lifting or something like that. But those are pretty well healed at the 2 week post-op check, and the skin glue that we use to kind of complete closure is gone by then. So I was like, if you're feeling like it at 2 weeks, go back to your normal activities.
Awesome, that's pretty incredible. All these advancements in medicine.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Awesome. And I was like, and like I mentioned earlier, I was like, some people have a tubal at the time of other surgery, like at the time of their hysterectomy, or sometimes when they're undergoing a cesarean section, and you know, really doing a tubal adds nothing to the recovery at that point.
Yeah, might as well go ahead and do that. So do you counsel patients, you know, if they are thinking about it, to go ahead and do that with the C-section, or do you encounter individuals that are, you know, hesitant to do that?
Yeah, I was like, I think the people who are hesitant are just hesitant in general about tying their tubes, because most people are like, yes, I'm already open, go for it. I was like, tying your tubes, I think there's so many falsehoods about potential consequences from it down the road, as far as like your periods and things like that go, which we'll kind of debunk. That most people, I was like, once they have the conversation with their physician, go ahead and have it done while they're already having surgery, rather than possibly undergo two surgeries, have to be put to sleep twice. And the cost associated with that as well.
Yeah, there you go. That's some good tips there. Well, we have Dr. Amanda Button here, OBGYN from Willis-Knighton Women's Health Clinic, here with us today for our Healthline. If you have a question for her, if you're just tuning in, please give us a call at 318-219-4569. And we'll be answering your questions here live.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me a little bit of like the possible risks or complications from these procedures.
Okay. Honestly, I was like, very low risk. I was like, it's kind of our minor surgery. But I was like, of course, anytime you undergo surgery, there is a potential for things, although uncommon. The biggest one, I'd say, is pain, because you're going to have incisions on your belly. So I was like, expect some pain after surgery. There is a risk of infection. But I always say, like, the infection risk is so low, especially with a laparoscopic procedure where the incisions are sub-centimeter in size, that we don't even give antibiotics preoperatively, because the infection risk is basically nothing. There is a risk of bleeding. The tubes are connected to the ovaries and the uterus, and there's very thin tissue called the mesosalpinx that has a bunch of little blood vessels in it, and it could tear very easily. So it's like a tube is a very delicate procedure, and if you kind of handle the tube too aggressively, those blood vessels can tear, and you can end up with a lot of bleeding that way. Very rare to have a lot of blood loss during these. These are usually pretty dry operations, but bleeding is a risk, so we always consent for the possibility to get a blood transfusion. There's also a risk of ectopic pregnancy, which means a pregnancy outside of the uterus, such as the tube or maybe even somewhere else. There's ovaries. Honestly, pregnancies will find any place to implant. There's like read stories about implanting on the vena cava and the omentum, which is a flat layer covering the organs, but the risk of tubal pregnancy was a lot higher when we were doing partial self-injectomies or the clips or the rings or just the removing a small segment or burning a small segment in the middle because you still had tube on either side. And so you would see more pregnancies in the tube with those. Now that we remove the entire tube completely, there's really not a place for you to have an ectopic minus outside of the uterus and tubes, which ovary, abdominal cavity itself, which is like extremely rare.
Extremely. Right. So since this, we're talking about permanent contraception, is there any way you can actually reverse this? Or since you're taking the tubes out, you can't really do that, I'm assuming.
Yes, so now that we're doing bilateral self-injectomies and removing the tubes whole, we cannot really reverse that. In order to reverse a tubal, you have to have some sort of tube there to put back together. I know when we were doing Filshie clips, fallope rings, even the postpartum interval tubals, and we were, you know, kind of just messing with a mid portion of the tube, those were able to be reversed. And you definitely need like a certain amount of length of tube left too. And you know, those had pretty good success rates. It was like, I think pregnancy rates are quoted as like 50 to 80% after reversal for those types of procedures. But the way we do tubals now, like it's going to be permanent.
Right.
And your only option, if you do change your mind, is to undergo in vitro fertilization, which is a very expensive endeavor.
Right, exactly. So with this advancement, you guys don't do the clips or the rings at all?
No.
Right, okay. So
no, WK. I was like, the failure rate was actually higher for those types of things compared to, you know, burning or removing a midsection of the tube. So I was like, I'm sure, you know, personally at our hospital, we don't do postpartum, like immediate postpartum tubals for scheduling purposes. It's just hard to kind of add a last minute case, you know, on the whim. So we kind of schedule all of ours out postpartum, but some people probably still are doing postpartum tubal and removing a small middle midsection of each tube, which you could potentially get reversed, but again, expensive and it's not 100%.
So you want to be sure
before
you have this
100%,
procedure.
Yes. Yeah. When I counsel my patients, I'm like, you have to be 100% sure, think worst case scenario. Like if something happened to one of your kids, would you want another child? If you and your husband split up and you got remarried, would you want another child? Like you've got to play out all of the bad things that you really would not want to think about before you do something like this.
For sure. Yeah, because like you said, it's pretty much permanent. So you want to be 100% sure for sure. So if someone is considering this procedure and they're wondering if they are a good candidate, is there anybody that has maybe other underlying risk factors that may not be a good candidate for this procedure?
So the best way to find out is to talk to your doctor, because they're really going to be the best judge of who is and who is not a good candidate. But I'll tell you, the majority of people are. The one thing you want to consider is like, is it safe for you to undergo general anesthesia? I was like, are you, you know, very obese with sleep apnea, like diabetes, hypertension? Is it safe for you to go to sleep under general anesthesia? And then the other thing that's really important is how much scar tissue is in your abdomen from other procedures. Mm-hmm. Are we going to be able to safely accomplish this, or are we going to run the risk of injuring other organs or possibly leading to hysterectomy, loss of ovary, stuff like that?
Right. So if I'm assuming if someone was not a good candidate, maybe they had too much scar tissue, would you recommend then just oral contraceptives from that point?
There are honestly like a bunch of different options for contraception. My favorite besides tubal, as we're talking effectiveness wise, mm-hmm. is an IUD. However, if I was going to pick my favorite, I would say vasectomy, because okay. it is the safest, most effective, and has the least amount of downtime.
Cool.
So it's like if men could step up and take one for the team.
right.
I was like, women do so much, you know, getting pregnant and mm-hmm. delivering, and pregnancy itself is a very dangerous state too. So I was like, women have done their fair share of the work.
Well, you heard it first.
Yes.
Right here from
yes.
OBGYN.
But yeah, it's like lots of other options if you're not a candidate for a tubal.
Right. Well, cool. So tell me, is there any new techniques on the horizon for these procedures that we've been talking about? Any new techniques that you are excited to dive into, or you think that what you're doing now is pretty advanced?
Yeah, I think there's really not much else to gain from like taking out the tubes itself.
Right.
And technique wise, I mean, it's so minimally invasive, and I can't imagine there would be a better way of doing what we're doing right now.
If it's not broke, then don't fix it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Well, it's Cancer Prevention Awareness Month, and you mentioned that taking these tubes out can prevent your risk for ovarian cancer. So if you don't mind speaking on, you know, how or when your risk for ovarian cancer increases, I'd be interested to know.
Yeah. Most ovarian cancers are diagnosed in older women. I'm talking about 60s and older, although there is like a smaller subset where even teens, 20s and 30s can get ovarian cancer. It's not unheard of. But ovarian cancer, unfortunately, is very aggressive, and usually when it's diagnosed, it's diagnosed at an advanced stage, usually stage mm-hmm. 3 when it is diagnosed. We don't have a lot of good screening tests for ovarian cancer, which is why I think it goes undiagnosed for so long and is diagnosed at such a late stage. So, you know, with cervical cancer, you come in and do your pap smears. Uterine cancers usually kind of present with abnormal bleeding or postmenopausal bleeding, but there's really not any good symptoms or studies to diagnose ovarian cancer. So any way that we could decrease that risk of ovarian cancer, right. I'm like, take full advantage of it.
Absolutely, for sure. So that's a good, another plus. You know, we've been talking about the misconceptions of permanent contraception, and so I think that that's probably one of the best things going
yes.
for it.
I hear a lot too about patients being worried about how a tubal is going to affect their cycles. I hear, okay, after my friend had her tubes tied, she says her cycles became so much heavier, so much more painful, and a lot of patients are wary about tying their tubes just because of that. But the tubes have nothing to do with your periods. Mm-hmm. And so tying your tubes really should not affect your periods whatsoever. It's a completely separate issue. I was like, your uterus is responsible for your periods. Your ovaries are what produce the hormones that work on your uterus to have your period. And so the tubes are kind of left out completely. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people fail to realize is they are stopping their birth control pills, their birth control patch, taking out their IUDs now that their tubes are tied, because they no longer need those things for contraception. But those things are actually treating a lot of their period issues.
Oh,
like,
right.
Contraception is a lot of the treatment for heavy periods and painful periods mm-hmm. and irregular periods.
Because of the hormone mm-hmm. balancing act that it does for it?
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, so that would be something maybe that you could help address, like let's say after the permanent contraception procedure, Oh my goodness, I'm still having a lot of pain. Then I guess that's something that you could.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, plenty of people will come back and say, okay, yeah. Got my tubes tied. I'm happy I'm not on birth control anymore, but God, my periods are so heavy now. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but you might need birth control now on top of it. Or you can have, you know, an ablation done, a procedure where we destroy the lining of the uterus so that there's no lining there to bleed every month, or even goes so far as to have a hysterectomy.
Right. So would you recommend having your tubes tied the same time as having an ablation done, or do you recommend separate procedures?
Honestly, with an ablation, we do recommend some form of permanent contraception because it is not advised whatsoever to get pregnant after an ablation. I was like, very dangerous pregnancies. If you were to become pregnant, it probably would not be a normal pregnancy. So we kind of require some form of permanent contraception along with an ablation. So we do a lot of tying tubes, ablations together.
At the same time?
Yes.
Okay. Now what's the recovery like with that?
Really, I was like, the tubal is probably the worst part of it with the incisions on the belly because the ablation is done through the vagina. Besides, you know, cramping after the ablation and, you know, light bleeding or vaginal discharge afterwards, it's very minimal as well.
Gotcha. Very cool. So I've got Dr. Amanda Button here with me from WK Women's Health Clinic. And if you have a question for her, if you're just now tuning in, please give us a call at 318-219-4569. We'll be taking your calls and you can ask her directly if you have a specific question for her. So let's just dive right back into our questions. So with the procedure that we've been talking about, the surgical procedure of permanent contraception, what are some other things that, like the recovery process, what are some other things that you can expect afterwards? Maybe not just recovery, but even other things as far as menstruation or anything else we didn't talk about.
So, as mentioned, I was like, really, periods should not change unless your periods kind of were a problem beforehand and you unmask it now by stopping your contraceptive. But honestly, it shouldn't interfere with sexual function, libido. It does not put you into menopause, has no effect on your hormones. Honestly, I was like, it's literally there just for reproductive purposes, and now we know decreases ovarian cancer risk too. So
cool. Is that one thing that people are concerned about when they come and ask you about this procedure? Like, is it going to alter hormones? And maybe that's a common misconception.
Yes. That, and along with the cycles being made worse by it or having chronic pain afterwards or something like that is probably the most common. And then a lot of women don't know that they're candidates. They think they have to have like 3 kids, 4 kids, or have to be married, or, you know, have to have permission, like their doctor is the one to decide for them. But you don't have to have a certain number of kids. I mean, you could have no kids. I was like, it's your decision. Mm-hmm. So I don't kind of push that on my patients, although I counsel, like, the risk of regret is a lot higher when you're younger. In your 20s, the risk of regret is quoted up to 20%. So I was like, you really want to consider it very seriously when you're that young. But even women who are in their 30s and have 3 kids could regret it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it's just such a personal decision. But as far as regret goes, women who have their tubes tied within like the first 2 to 3 years of having their last baby are the ones who usually regret it the most. If your youngest baby is 8 years or older, tend to regret it less. Or interestingly enough, if you have never had children, regret is lower, I guess, maybe because you don't know what it's missing.
Like to have it. Yeah. Very interesting. So you do a lot of counseling.
Yes. Now I was like, we will ask you 1 million times before this. Are you sure?
That's good.
Are you sure? Are you sure? Right. Last minute on the table. Are you sure?
Especially if you're gung-ho one day and then the next day you just never know.
Yes. So, and I've had patients tell me like they know from a young age they never wanted children, like the thought of having children or becoming pregnant gives them anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like they need to have something permanently done for their peace of mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm all about that. Like
right.
If you have thought about it this much and it's causing you distress, yes, mm-hmm. I will tie your tubes. So I was like, given you know that it's permanent, can't be reversed, and if you ever want to have children again, it's going to take in vitro fertilization.
Right.
I was like,
right.
We're adults, we can make our own decisions.
Like you said, one of the only requirements is to be a consenting adult. Yeah. To be able to make these hard decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you recommend if someone has this procedure and they maybe had heavy or painful periods before? What would you recommend after they have this procedure? Do you recommend they stay on the contraceptive? Is there one that you recommend over the other?
Honestly, I was like, it's a very case-by-case basis and depending on, you know, other comorbidities, because not everybody can use a estrogen-containing pill or estrogen-containing mm-hmm. patch or ring. Some, you know, hypertensive patients can't use estrogen. People with history of blood clots can't use estrogen. And so it really depends on what you can take. There isn't, I'd say, like, you know, one better contraceptive over the other, although an IUD and the implant in the arm are going to be your next two that are very high efficacy wise, that are about 99% effective, compared to like patches and mm-hmm. rings and pills that are probably, you know, only 93% effective, I think is what's quoted. Because
wow.
Okay. Of user error.
Oh, okay.
Because
yeah.
People forget their pills or forget to replace their patch or replace their ring. And so I was like, if you use it every single day, just like you're supposed to, yes, probably 99% effective. But day-to-day life, you know, we kind of forget things.
Right.
Whereas an intrauterine device, the IUD that goes inside the uterus, we place that in the office.
You don't have to worry
about it. It's good from 5 to 10 years, depending on what you choose. And the implant that we put in the arm is good for 3 years. And so I was like, those are kind of dummy proof. Like, we put them in mm-hmm. for you and you don't have to do anything about it.
So I actually have a personal question, because the IUD, I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions out
oh,
there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With that.
Yeah, I'll probably
and,
give a whole talk on that one too by
right.
itself.
And just real quick, you know, I've read some things where they can move or you can have an ectopic pregnancy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you debunk maybe just a couple of those myths that you commonly see?
Now, those are real risks.
Okay.
They are. I wouldn't say they are common by any means. These are kind of like very rare occurrences, like over my... Oh, how long have I been doing this? I was like 12 years residency in private practice. I think I've seen 3 IUDs outside of a uterus. And I think a lot of it, not that it like dug its way out, I really think these are probably placed incorrectly from the beginning.
Gotcha.
And then risk of ectopic pregnancy, I'm like, yes, it's like, this is why I think it's 99% effective and not 100% effective. But yes, if someone does become pregnant with an IUD, that's a red flag that it probably is in the tube.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, where can we find you if somebody is wanting to learn a little bit more about this procedure that we've been talking about, tying your tubes, or even just seeing you as their OBGYN? Where can we find you? Location, website, phone number, all the things.
I am located at Willis-Knighton South campus at the Physician Center building. It's called the Women's Health Clinic. Our phone number is 318-212-5790. I am in a group of 5 physicians. We are all accepting new patients. And our website, I think, is womenshealthclinic.com. It's like you can Google it and
it'll pop right up.
It'll pop up.
Or Google your name as well.
Yes.
Too. Awesome. Well, we have Dr. Amanda Button, obstetrician and gynecologist here. She's actually my OB. She's pretty great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So such a great time talking with you about all these advancements. And again, if you wanted to get on her patient list, then visit WK Women's Health Clinic. On their website and give them a call and they'll get you in.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Come on.
All right. Well, this has been a great Healthline today, talking all about permanent contraception, and we'll be back again with another Healthline later this week. And thanks again for having me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome.